Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Hello, everyone. My name is Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a Broadway legend and highly respected actor who's been dazzling audiences for over 50 years. He starred in 14 Broadway shows, including Minnie's Boys, for which he won a Theatre World Award and a Drama Desk Award, Candide, which earned him a Tony Award nomination for Best Actor in a Musical, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which earned him a second Tony Award nomination for Best Featured Actor in a Musical, The Sunshine Boys, the female version of The Odd Couple, Laughter on the 23rd Floor, The Front Page, and The Man Who Came to Dinner, which earned him a Drama Desk Award nomination for Outstanding Feature Actor in a Play. On the big screen, he appeared in numerous films, including Portnoy's Complaint, Serpico, The Verdict, To Be or Not to Be, and In and Out. And on TV, you've seen him in dozens of shows, including Benson, Law and Order, The Sopranos, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Damages, and Smash. He's worked with everyone from Hal Prince, Shelley Winters, Mickey Rooney, Donald O'Connor, and Henry Fonda to Mel Brooks, Nathan Lane, Rita Moreno, Hal Linden, Richard Dreyfuss, Christine Baranski, and dozens more. He starred in 9 national touring companies of beloved shows, including Fiddler on the Roof, Guys and Dolls, Oklahoma, The Producers, and the 2018 revival of Hello, Dolly, which forms the subject of his brand new book, Save Me a Seat, On the Road with Hello, Dolly. This is a wonderfully entertaining account of our guest's year on the road in a 26-city tour with the national company of Hello, Dolly, in which he played Horace Vandergelder alongside the one and only Betty Buckley as Dolly Levi. This engrossing book is full of great anecdotes and insights about the theater world, as well as many astute observations about the state of America's urban culture, hotels, restaurants, baseball teams, and the realities of life on the road. This is our guest's second book. His first book is a wonderful memoir published in 2009 entitled Acting Foolish, which is a refreshingly frank, insightful, and sometimes hilarious exploration of his remarkable journey as an actor. I'm delighted to welcome the incomparable Louis J. Stadlin to our show. Mr. Stadlin, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, you deserved it. There's a famous quote from Moss Hart who said that the theater is the inevitable refuge of the unhappy child. I know your parents divorced when you were 10 years old, but were you an unhappy child?
I was a confused child. I'm still confused to the extent of why I had such difficulty approaching new things. I've written in the book that I've spent a lot of my life putting a square peg into a round hole. I was always resistant to learning new things, and it was not until I went to a theater camp when I was 14 and realized that I actually had a talent for something, that I was able to tear off the shackles of feeling misplaced in the world.
You wrote that your family suffered from a scarcity of forgiveness. What did you mean by that?
Well, everybody had made capital on the weaknesses of others. The one thing that was constant my grandfather, who I loved very much, my maternal grandfather, he created a system in which nobody could be better than he was. And how that manifested was that my mother, who both loved him, adored him, and hated him because he never gave her affirmation, the men in the family never measured up to the excellence of my grandfather. And I think that to a certain extent, that created a neurotic sensibility that, you know, I try to explore in both books.
You studied under Stella Adler, who asked you, do you want to be an actor or do you want to be a star? What was your answer?
Well, initially, I wanted to be a star. I thought, well, that's an easy question. The star gets all the good parts. It was not until many years later that I realized what she was actually saying, which was that to be a star is an occupation unto itself. You know, you have to hire a hairdresser to make sure that your 12 hairs, you know, are at a maximum effect. I realized that it was exhausting. After Candide, in which I achieved star billing beneath the title that was never in any of the ads, I realized that I didn't have that type of extraordinary ambition, in which I never wanted to be the center of attention of every endeavor that I took part in. To be an actor is to be a colleague. And I never wanted to bypass the experience of helping others, because I was helped so much by actors who knew so much more than I. And that's how I became a good actor.
Well, yeah, I think the difference between an actor and a star is that an actor is a professional and a star main occupation is being a celebrity. If you're a coffee lover like me, it's always fun to discover a great new blend. I recently found a terrific new company, Breakfast at Dominique's, that's created a series of coffee blends to honor the legacies of the greatest Hollywood legends. And I'm thrilled to tell you that now, Breakfast at Dominique's has introduced the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend. It's my very own exclusive, delicious, bold, rich, balanced, medium roast coffee, and I just know you're going to love it. It's made from high-quality organic beans produced using fair trade practices. If you'd like a great cup of coffee, give Breakfast at Dominique's a try and order the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend at hollywoodblends.com. They'll ship it right to your door anywhere in the world. Sipping our coffee is the perfect way to watch our show. Now, when you were 19, you were cast in the role of Mendel, the rabbi's son, in the national touring company of Fiddler on the Roof. You wrote that seeing Zero Mostel's performance as Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway changed your life. How so?
There was something beautifully grotesque about Zero Mostel. He was a strange-looking man, and he was an explosive personality. And what he didn't shy away from the negative aspects of the human condition, which was something that I feel that whenever I have performed, I always try to find the flaw in the character that I'm playing. And then I beat on it all night. And there's something comedic about that, because people in the audience recognize the flaw and they find it amusing because they realize that they themselves have this flaw. Zero was just a genius. And I had a few instances. I didn't know him well, but we lived a half a block away from each other, and he adored me because he knew that I adored him. And I went to see him in, I had performed with Luther Adler, who I didn't think was a particularly good Tevye, and Paul Lipson, who was a very good Tevye. And a few years later, Zero came back in a summer stock production of Fiddler on the Roof. And I went to his opening night and I sat in the first row. And he must have seen that I was, you know, just adoring him. And during the dream sequence, he left the woman playing Golda, Thelma Lee, and he sat in my lap for a good minute and a half. And the audience, of course, was screaming. Afterwards, I went over to Madeline Guilford, who was a lifelong friend, Jack Guilford's wife. And I said, would you please introduce me to Zero? And she introduced me. I had just done Minnie's Boy, so I was kind of the flavor of the month. And I said, Mr. Mostel, you know, I'm Louis J. Stadlin. You sat in my lap. And he said, and do you know, I sat in your lap. And I said, no, why? He said, because I was tired. So whenever I would spend time with Zero and a number of other great actors, they were always memorable. They were memorable events. And there was no baloney. There was no artifice. They just approached you and they treated you like you were their best friend. And I include people like Julie Harris, Jason Robards Jr., Maureen Stapleton. These were people, they all had egos, definitely, or they couldn't have succeeded to the extent that they did. But they were good egos, positive egos, not destructive egos.
Yeah, I have found exactly the same thing in interviewing people. The more talented they are, the greater they are, the nicer they are. Now, many actors who've appeared on our show have told me that the greatest enemy of an artist is to be excessively self-critical. You wrote that as a young man, you had such self-doubt that only the specter of invisibility made you ambitious. How did you strike a balance between being objective about yourself and your work and being paralyzed with self-doubt?
And when I went to the summer camp, that was this perfect microcosm of what the theater should be. It was called Grey Gables Theater Workshop. I realized that I was having a different effect on people, especially women. And that was has always been very important to me. All of a sudden, they weren't treating me like a nerd. They were treating me like, oh, this person has something to offer. I was never paralyzed by self-criticism, but I think I certainly was objective enough to know when I was succeeding and when I was failing. For instance, after I did Minnie's Boys and everybody was touting me as this great genius, which I am definitely not, I tried to get as far away from it as I possibly could. So I did a play at the Public Theater. It was an agitprop piece about the insanity of the Vietnam War. The Happiness Cage was the name of it. I didn't know how to act. I did a really good job of imitating Groucho Marx. I was a terrific mimic. And I walked away from that experience and I said, you have a lot to learn. I've been bad in my career, but not often. And I was fortunate enough to get into the national company of The Time of Your Life, in which I was surrounded by these great actors, Henry Fonda, Strother Martin, Victor French, and Richard Dreyfuss was in it as well. And I learned from them. I had been given a good start by Stella Adler, who taught me some actual craft elements. One of them being, you have to figure out what side of the political equation you're on. How do you fit in to the puzzle of the play? Making decisions, specifying everything. So I wasn't paralyzed, but I think that I was aware of when I was giving a good performance and when I was letting myself down.
I've had many stars tell me that to make it in show business, you need good luck as much as you need talent. Do you agree with that, Mr. Stadlin?
Absolutely. Because when there are lulls in your career and you're trying to find some alternative way of earning a living, you can get so down on yourself and so down on your surroundings that when good luck passes you by, you will not see it. And Minnie's Boys, which gave me an entree to having an acting career, I was doing the national company of Fiddler on the Roof. I had just returned to it after a year and a half of questioning what I wanted to do with my life. And I had a girlfriend, Elizabeth Hale, and she said to me, they're auditioning for the role of Groucho Marx and the rest of the Marx Brothers in this musical. And I was in Philadelphia at the time. And I was just happy to be there. You know, I figured out that, okay, maybe I'm not going to be the world's greatest actor, but at least I'm earning a living now. And I have an identity. And she said, you have to go in to New York and audition for this. And I said, I don't want to do that. I'm happy here. And fortunately, one of my great mentors and friends and surrogate father, Fivish Finkel, he said, you have to go in. I said, but where am I going to get an accompanist? And he said, my son, Elliot, who was 16 years old at the time, he will be your accompanist. And so I dragged myself kicking and screaming to that audition. Now, if I had just said no, then who knows, you know, where my life would have taken me.
Yeah, that's so true. Following your performance on Broadway in Candide and your falling out with Harold Prince, which you wrote about in your first book, you were for a long time perceived within the acting community as an underdog. Did that bother you?
Oh, I don't know if I was, I considered myself an underdog. I didn't feel that I received enough recognition from Candide because I thought that Hal Prince, you know, this is the problem. You know, when you're dealing, you could be the star of a show, which I was in Candide, but if they decide to publicize the genius of Harold Prince, then, you know, you get tossed aside. I've always considered myself not an underdog, but perhaps underappreciated. I think I've written in the book that considering how long I've been in the theater, I am kind of amazingly unfamous. But part of that is because I've never been good at self-promotion. And I think that that's a major part of wanting to be a star. For instance, Richard Dreyfuss, who I shared a dressing room with in
the time of your life.
This was a bump in the road for him. He wanted to get out of that company as fast as he could and run back to Hollywood and become a star. And he was a person who had such belief in the power of his own personality. And I'm telling you, it wasn't until I was 45 years old that I even realized I had a personality. And that's the reason why I always have gravitated to characters who are apart from myself, in which I could then grasp perhaps the personality of something that I felt lacking in myself. I've also written that to be a star, one has to maximize their own sex appeal. And I think that I have found that in the sense of being a character actor, but stars, for the most part, are people that have a certain sexual magnetism that I felt I lacked. My sexual magnetism is rarefied.
Well, that's a very interesting comment. I know that Hume Cronyn told you that he felt he had never become a really big star because he wasn't sexy enough, and you felt that that applied to you. I would beg to differ. I've seen performances of yours, especially when you were younger, and I thought you had a lot of sex appeal. But there's no question that you have never really achieved the status of a household name. In fact, there was a 10-year period, starting in your mid-20s, when you didn't appear on Broadway because you said you had developed a reputation for having a bit of an attitude because you weren't afraid to stand up for yourself. Do you think the culture on Broadway today would have made it easier for you back then?
No, I think it would have been harder today. I can't imagine what it must be like for a young person breaking in. No, I think that one was given more license to be a pain in the ass when I was starting out. I would have handled, I'm proud of the fact that I stood up to people who I felt were exploiting me. But with the wisdom of age and the fatigue of age, you realize that there are different ways of handling things. I have worked with certain actors and especially actresses who martyr themselves and they get in their own way. I'll tell you a story of Sally Struthers. Okay, Sally Struthers was the finest comedic actress I've ever worked with. In the female version of The Odd Couple, I would have paid money to be on the stage with her certain nights. She was so creative. We were in a situation in which we went out on the road for 6 months. It was no certainty that we were going to come to Broadway. And Neil Simon decided that, yes, we would. And Manny Eisenberg was the producer. And so they were going to close the show down after 6 months. They were going to take the prerequisite time that you needed to remount it. We brought in a great director, Gene Sachs, was a great director for comedy. But we were allowed to renegotiate our contract. And I remember going to dinner with Sally in Chinatown when we were in Washington, D.C., and we were all in the midst of renegotiating, and they were not giving her due. And Manny Eisenberg was somebody who takes a tremendous amount of pride in his Jewish heritage. As a matter of fact, he would take groups to Israel annually. And Sally said to me, "They're treating me so badly and they won't give me a raise." She said, and I said to Manny Eisenberg, "You're treating me like a Nazi." And I went, "You said to Manny Eisenberg that he's treating you like a Nazi?" I said, "Well, you'll be lucky if you get the same amount of money that you're getting now, let alone renegotiate your contract."
Yeah, she shot herself in the foot with that comment.
Woof.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned the money issue. Both of your books provide a lot of insight into the financial considerations that actors have to deal with. For example, in the year 2000, you were offered $50,000 to be in the TV movie version of Laughter on the 23rd Floor to play the role of Milt Fields, which you played on Broadway. You turned it down because it wasn't enough money. Have you ever regretted that decision?
No, I never regretted that decision. And I have to put that in context. If they had just come and said, "Here's $50,000 for 4 weeks' work," I would have been thrilled. The problem was that I was teaching at the North Carolina School of the Arts, and Manny Eisenberg, who is certainly the nicest producer I've ever worked for, I've worked for Manny many times, he called me up and told me that they were going to call me Showtime, and they were going to make this offer. And I said, "Do you mind telling me how much?" And he said, "It'll be between $75,000 and $100,000. And I thought, "Ooh, that's generous." Well, that never came to pass. And then I found out that some other actors who were not in it were making $100,000. And I felt, I'm not going to work for 50% of, let's say, what Victor Garber is making. And then, of course, I spoke with Nathan, who was playing the lead that he had created. And he said, "Were you in Titanic?" I said, "No, I wasn't in Titanic, but I was one of the better things in that play. And I'm not working for 50% of what other people are making." So, no, I never regretted it. Now, what happened was then I went to Pittsburgh and did a staged reading of a play at Carnegie Mellon for $325 a week. And I remember thinking, you're a strange fellow. You turned down $50,000. You could be staying at the Royal York in Toronto. And now you're staying in this horrible apartment, you know, in Oakland, you know, outside of Pittsburgh. You're a strange duck.
But you're a principled man, I will say that. I want to ask you about some of the people you've worked with, starting with Shelley Winters. You wrote that I'm quoting you here. She demanded to be difficult as a means of exhausting the world around her. Now, I've had guests say the same thing about Elaine Stritch and other stars as well. Have you ever been able to figure out what makes some celebrities behave that way?
No, I have the feeling that Shelley just behaved that way, you know, on stage or off. She was hideous to work with. She was terrible. And also she, being in a musical comedy at her age was not one of her strong suits. She had memory issues, but she was incredibly selfish. And she wasn't the only reason why Minnie's Boys failed. The book, the libretto, was based on the conflict was, will the Marx Brothers ever become successful? Well, of course, you know, they tried to make it. It was like the same. It was like a gypsy, but Gypsy wasn't about Gypsy Rose Lee. Basically, it was about the mother, who was a much more interesting and controversial figure. No, Shelley, I've never worked with anyone who compared with Shelley in terms of professional dysfunction.
Well, what about Mickey Rooney, with whom you toured in The Sunshine Boys? He once described his acting style as exploring the explosive. You wrote that you had a love-hate relationship with Mickey Rooney. Tell me about that.
Oh, it was mostly love. I love Mickey Rooney and some of the great stories. You know, the thing is, it's the stories about dysfunction that are the good theatrical anecdotes. When everything goes well, you know, there's really basically nothing to write about.
Yeah.
Or even tell an anecdote about. Mickey was, you know, at 3 years of age, as Mickey Maguire, was just thrown out there. He never had to make he never was allowed to make a choice about what he was going to do with the rest of his life. The story with Mickey was that when I got to him, and he was, I think, 69 years old, as a matter of principle, he was not going to learn the lines as written. And just before the first performance, we were at the Bob Carr Auditorium in Orlando. I'm sitting there. It's 5 minutes. I have to go up on stage with him. He doesn't know any of the lines. Or a few lines he does know, he paraphrases, which is death when you're doing Neil Simon. And I thought, what am I going to do? This is like King Lear of comedy, you know. All he's never off stage. And he calls me over, and Mickey could get like very pompous, you know. And he said to me, let me tell you something. He said, this play is never going to be Sweet Bird of Youth. I said, no, it's not. I said, but it is The Sunshine Boys. And he said, do you have cancer? I said, what? He said, do you have cancer? I said, no. He said, then what the hell are you worried about? And then he went out on stage and he made a total ass out of himself. And a few days later, I said to him, Mickey, at least you got to learn the play sequentially. All right. Well, it was the Mickey Rooney adaptation of The Sunshine Boys, which I had done on Broadway, and it originated this role when I was 25, you know, now I was 41. And I thought, you know, you're working with Mickey Rooney. Throw the book away on this. Neil Simon's never going to come see this play. He's just going to cash the checks. And I had such a wonderful time with Mickey. And, you know, the idea of my character was to sit there and listen to this madman who was my uncle. And the fact that Mickey was a genius, here's a story. A number of years later, the same director called me up and he said, now don't laugh. He said, but the Pasadena Playhouse wants Mickey to play Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. And he wants you to play Biff. Well, I thought, nobody's ever going to ask me to play Biff Loman, but Mickey Rooney. And I thought, if Mickey ever learned the lines, which of course he wouldn't, he would be a brilliant Willie Loman, because he was one of the most talented people on the face of the earth. So I loved working with Mickey. And even though he basically subverted the piece, I felt privileged to work with somebody of his talent.
And what I find so fascinating about that is that you started this interview by saying you've always had difficulty adjusting to new things, but look at how flexible and how resilient you've been in your career. Look at what you've had to adjust to. I think you've proven over and over again that you actually are able to adapt to new situations, new sets of people, new places. You're the walking definition of someone who can do that.
Only within the context of the theater, of being an actor.
Well, that's a pretty big context. And yeah. Another thing, in 1972, you went on tour with Henry Fonda in The Time of Your Life. What was it like to work with him?
Nirvana. And he was, I think I caught Henry at the happiest that he had ever been in his life. And this was Plumstead Playhouse. He was one of the producers with Martha Scott and Alfred De La Iagra, who was, again, an old time, wonderful, dignified producer. He just was, first of all, incredibly generous to me. And when Groucho Marx died, I got a phone call from Henry. And he said, Groucho died, and I don't know when there's going to be a memorial service, but when I find out, I'll give you all the details. And I had seen Henry maybe one or two times. Other than that, when somebody is the star of the play, Nathan Lane, I've done, I think, 8 or 9 plays with Nathan Lane. They take the responsibility of learning the lines before everybody else. They set the standard that you have to live up to. On a number of occasions, I've been the leading actor too, and I have taken that responsibility, but that's because I was mentored by the likes of Henry. We almost did The Time of Your Life in London, and we were all set to go. And Henry, at 69 years old, this living legend, had the same insecurity as any other actor. He was afraid he was never going to get cast in another film. And at the last moment, he took another film, which I don't think turned out to be, particularly memorable. And we never got to play London. But the idea that Henry Fonda dealt with the same insecurities as any of the rest of us is, that show business, folks.
Well, and it's the human condition, no matter how famous you are. Now, since you've mentioned Groucho Marx, you portrayed him in Minnie's Boys on Broadway. You became a sensation. In fact, after seeing your performance, Groucho Marx said that you were the only one he would ever allow to impersonate him on TV or in the movies. How nerve-wracking was it for you to be playing Groucho in front of Groucho?
Well, we met at Sardi's. We were in previews. Minnie's Boys were in previews, I think, for 84 performances. We set the record at the time. And Alvin Kupperman, who played Zeppo, and I, we were having dinner at Sardi's. And as we were leaving to do the evening show, Arthur Whitelaw, the producer, said, "Wait a second, I want to introduce you to somebody." And there was Groucho, looking very dapper in his turtleneck and beret. And
he said, "Who are you?"
I said, "My name is Lewis Stadlin."
He said, and what do you do?"
I said, "I'm playing you, Groucho."
He said, "And who are you?" And
Alvin Kupperman said, I'm Alvin Kupperman."
"And who do you play?"
He said, "I'm playing Zeppo."
And he said, "Well, you look like you have as little talent as Zeppo had."
And that's how I met Groucho. And he not only was he incredibly generous to me, but he came to see me in every play that I was in. He would always come backstage. If I was in Los Angeles, he would find me. He was extraordinarily generous. And yes, that's true. He would not allow anybody else to play him except me. So I did a couple of TV commercials. And when I was doing the Happiness Cage at the Public, we were in rehearsal. I was in the green room, and the stage manager came over to me and said, this was like a year and a half after Minnie's Boys. She said, "There's a man on the phone who says he's Groucho Marx." And I said, "Yeah, it's Groucho." And I got on the phone, and he said, "This TV series, you don't want to do the TV series?" I said, "Groucho, I can't do that. You're the one they want to see, Groucho. I did a very good job, I think, figuring out who you were. So I was not, giving, saying the same word. I realized that Groucho Marx was a person who could take the most neutral statement and turn it skeptical. He was like always, looking up to God, like, why is life so unfair? I said, I can't do this anymore, or I'll be typed forever as the person who only can play Groucho Marx. He said, I understand.
Well, you are such a gift, my Lord. Well, I want to ask you now about Mel Brooks, with whom you worked on the movie To Be or Not to Be. He treated you, in my opinion, brutally. He was extremely disrespectful and hypercritical of everything you did. So I have to ask you, after the way he treated you, how did you have the guts to audition for him for the role of Max Bialystock in the national tour of the producers?
Well, you talk about me making healthy adjustments. What was I doing with Nathan? I think we were doing The Time of Your Life. Not The Time, The Man Who Came to Dinner. And Nathan came to me and he said, they're doing a musical version of The Producers and they're offering me the part of Max Bialystock. What do you think? I said, don't do it. He said, don't do it. Why wouldn't I do it? I said, because first of all, I remember you not liking the direction by Susan Stroman of The Music Man, and Mel can be a monster, and the two of them it's combustible. Plus, nobody's going to be better than Zero Mostel. And Nathan said, oh, so if they offered you the part, you would turn it down? I said, yes, I would. I would turn it down. All right. I go to see the, I think, final preview of The Producers, which was spectacular. And Nathan was brilliant. And I got down on my knees and I said, Louis J. Stadlin is wrong again. All right. I went in, you talk about Zero. The thing that fueled Zero was rage. He was an angry man. And Max Bialystock is a angry man. And so is Mel Brooks. And I remember when they asked me to audition, I went to the musical director to work on the song, The King of Old Broadway, which is very complicated, a lot of lyrics. And he said, nobody knows how to do the Mel Brooks style of comedy. Everybody's playing it like Eugene O'Neill. I said, I know how to do the Mel Brooks style of comedy. The joke is on Max Bialystock. You are the buffoon. You are the heroic coward, a la Bob Hope. I know how to do this. And I went in and I had an axe to grind with Mel. And I remember Mel saying to me, 10 people there while I'm auditioning. And Mel said, didn't we have a wonderful time when we were doing To Be or Not to Be? Wasn't that great? And I thought, boy, talk about a man who had a selective memory. And I went, yeah, it was really great. So when you act, or when I act, you have to write your own play beneath the words. The words are dead on a piece of paper. You have to create active reasons for speaking. You have to know who you're speaking to. And Mel sitting there, I was, my hidden agenda was, I'm going to show you. I know you guys are all panicked because you have to send out a road company and you can't find anybody. And you've convinced yourself that the only person who could play this part is Nathan Lane. I'm going to show you I can play Max Bialystock. So my complicated relationship with Mel fed me. And that was the reason why I was very good as Max Bialystock.
Yeah, you really are an amazing person to channel and harness that emotion into fueling your performance. Now, you co-starred in the female version of The Odd Couple, which contained, in my opinion, some brilliant comedic scenes, but it was also, in my opinion, very unfairly panned by the critics. Why do you think the critics were so harsh?
The critics. I remember when I first read it and I auditioned for it, I thought, what is this? This is a stunt. First of all, what happened was that we were doing, with the exception of the scene in which Tony Shalhoub and I were playing the Costasuela brothers, in which it was distaff. They took the Pigeon Sisters and they, you know, changed it around the genders. They were playing poker for the first 6 months when we did it on the road. And the idea of women playing poker, it just didn't have, you know, the same conciseness, the same rhythm as men playing poker. The other thing about the female version of The Odd Couple, and if critics didn't like it, they had a point. They didn't have the courage to make Rita Moreno's character a slob. She was reasonable and rational at all times. Sally's character was the Art Carney, Jack Lemmon character of being an obsessive compulsive pain in the ass. So that the conflict between them was not as powerful, sloppy person, obsessively neat. I've since read that play because I taught at Stella Adler's for a little while. And, well, you know, what I can teach young people about acting, I could teach them in 2 hours, basically. So what I did was, it was a scene study class. And one of the plays that I said they should do scenes from was the female version of The Odd Couple. And I remember reading it and going, this is really funny. And it also had a spectacular cast. Mary Louise Wilson, you know, it was Jenny O'Hara. It was great, but it wasn't as good as the original Odd Couple. Since then, I have seen any number of productions of the male version, which haven't been that good.
Now, Mr. Stadlin, you've worked with a lot of directors over the years, and you wrote about many of them in both of your books. As an actor, what do you do when a director insists that you play a part completely differently from the way your gut or your instincts are telling you to play the role?
You're screwed. There's no way to overcome it, because you come in with the idea of how you want the character to be. And then they come in and they say, no, I want you to do it 180 degrees from your instinct. So in order to mollify the director, because, you know, you don't want to be an anarchist in the rehearsal room, you don't do it his way exactly. You don't do it your way. You do it in the middle, and it's lousy. I remember having that experience. I did a Tom Stoppard play, Rough Crossing, in which I don't know what the director was telling me to do. But I've been very fortunate. And again, I think part of this is that in the latter part of my career, whenever anybody has interest in me, the first thing I always ask the agent, who's directing? Right. Because there are just certain people I know that we will not get along. The good directors are the ones that allow you to exhaust your instincts, and then they edit. And a good director is somebody who always gives you active direction as compared to metaphorical direction. So that if a director says to you, your character is like an asteroid going through space, that's nonsense. You can't play an asteroid, you know, going through space. But if a director says to you, something along the lines of what you're doing now, you have, this is a Sidney Lumet direction. And Sidney Lumet was a great director. When Sidney directed The Verdict and directed all of his plays, you had 2 weeks of rehearsal and you would rehearse it like a play. You'd go through the screenplay. So in The Verdict, and there with all these great actors, James Mason, my God, Jack Warden and Paul Newman. And the scene that I had with Paul Newman was, I'm this very fancy surgeon, and he's basically an alcoholic lawyer, and I convince him to take on this case of medical malpractice. And the way Sidney was going to direct it was, we would start in the locker room of the hospital, we'd go down a few flights of stairs, we'd walk through the hallway, we'd go down, I'd get into a Jaguar and peel off. Well, while we were doing this in the rehearsal room, Sidney had us walking around this in circles. And I kept looking at Sidney, looking at Paul Newman. And he said, don't look at Paul Newman. let Paul Newman catch up to you. Well, I was honored to be working with Paul Newman. I didn't want to be disrespectful, so I wanted to make eye contact, you know, with Paul Newman. And he kept saying, no, no, you're a famous surgeon and he's an alcoholic. Don't look back at him. Well, after doing this about four times, Sidney took me aside and he said, look, you're having an affair with a 25-year-old intern in Cambridge. You've got 3 hours to drive the car to Cambridge, make love to her, come back across the Charles River, and have the next, and then perform your next operation. 3 hours to do all of that. I never looked back at Paul Newman again.
Great direction. So let's talk about the subject of your new book, your performance as Horace Van de Gelder for a whole year in the touring production of Hello, Dolly! Opposite Betty Buckley. Now, I can't resist asking you, what did you think of David Hyde Pierce's performance in the Bette Midler production on Broadway?
I thought he was miscast. David Hyde Pierce is a wonderful, wonderful actor, but he resonates kindness. And when I saw the production and I was there opening night, he played him fussy and confused. And I had played Horace Van de Gelder first in The Matchmaker with Andrea Martin, and then three times, once with Randy Graff, Leslie Uggams, Leroy Reams did it in drag. All three marvelous. Four marvelous. I knew that character. And I thought, no, the fun of Horace Van de Gelder is that he is impenetrable. He is so arrogant. He is, his heart is cold. He thinks he knows the answer to everything. He believes that wealth is the only measure of human success. And he is deconstructed by this optimistic spirit. And he gradually, even though he's unconscious of it throughout the play, he falls in love with this woman. But he doesn't go easy. And he considers himself, he's a tyrant. He's a tyrant. And the fun of it is to break down the tyrannical aspects of his personality. And even though he's not really conscious that it's happening to him, because of the power of this woman. And David, I thought he was like fussy and confused. And indeed, Dolly is constantly confusing Horace Van de Gelder, but he recovers until the very end of the play, when he is basically shot through the eyes with Cupid's arrow. And the way I played him, he's reduced to infantilism. And what I always played the role with a kind of a gruff gutturalness, self-certainty. And then at the end, in the last scene, when he is so madly in love and asks her to marry him, I get rid of all of the vocal artifice and I just become me. And Andy Einhorn, who was the conductor of the Broadway show, gave me a wonderful note. I had been singing the reprise of Hello, Dolly, very presentationally, did a little Satchmo, you know. And he said, no, simplify it. Like you're talking to her, like you are professing your love. And that, I think that if Betty and I did something that was quite unique, the audience really felt that we were in love with each other at the end of the play. It wasn't just a plot contrivance. It was, we had fallen in love with each other, and Betty was such a fabulous actress that I think that Betty is really in love with me. And then the curtain would hit the deck and she would go, oh my God, I was, you know, I ate something for dinner and I was nauseous and I was afraid I was going to throw up on the stage. I thought, well, that's great acting.
Well, you know, it's so lamentable that they're casting big name movie stars and TV stars in leading roles in order to sell tickets, really, instead of casting the best actor for the part, which brings me to Bette Midler. I did see the Bette Midler production, I felt like I was watching the Bette Midler show. I mean, she did her best to be convincing as Dolly Levi, but there's no question the Divine Miss M persona keeps sneaking into the performance. How would you describe Betty Buckley's portrayal as compared to Bette Midler's?
Well, again, it was a privilege to work with Betty. I just love working with Betty. I was trepidatious when they hired her because, you know, Betty can cry over a bent fork, you know. I said that to her once. She said, you know, you make me cry at the end. And I said, well, you could cry over a bent fork. She said, what are you saying, that I'm a shallow actress? I said, no, I'm saying that your connection to your heart is you're so open-hearted when you perform. It's, you know, it's magnificent. Betty, who is not a funny person off stage, the first day of rehearsal, when she started to explore the character and realized that it was about optimism. It was about this woman who just loves life and loves abundance and doesn't respect the law, which basically is only put in place to protect property, right? Which is Horace Van de Gelder's modus operandi. I thought she's going to be great because she just, by embracing the optimism, while Bette, who is a magnificent performer, and I've known her for years and years and years and love her and everything she's done, basically, except this. She played her like a kind of a slightly cynical, self-disparaging woman. And that to me is not Betty, that to me is not Dolly Levi. The contrast between the man of who has a frozen heart and the woman who has a heart that she spreads to all the leading characters in Hello, Dolly. Hello, Dolly is about love, about the ability of people to fall in love within a 24-hour period. And so Betty understood that immediately and was really funny.
Yeah. Your tour of Hello, Dolly went to 26 cities across America. Do audience reactions differ from one city to the next?
You're a great interviewer.
Yes, thank you.
You are. You're great. And yes, absolutely. And that's one of the pleasures of being on the road. I'll give you an example. Baltimore is 30 miles away from Washington, D.C. The audience response could not be different.
Really?
Yeah, well, because Baltimore is blue collar. The people who live in Baltimore really live in Baltimore. The people who live in Washington, D.C. are basically transitory. They're transplants. You know, they come from different countries. They come, yeah, it's a government town. So there's a greater sophistication in Washington, D.C. Now, why the people on the Atlantic Ocean side of Florida are such terrible audiences, I'm talking about Miami and Palm Beach, as compared to the people who live in the middle of Florida on the Gulf side, Tampa and Orlando, it's a mystery to me. The other thing that's interesting, and this harkens back to the producers, they were panicked that it was so New York City Jewish centric that were people, you know, in the flyover states, were they going to get it? Were the conservative cities like Cincinnati and San Diego, were they going to get it? It was completely the opposite. The liberal cities like Minneapolis and San Francisco, those audiences didn't give themselves permission to laugh because of the politically incorrect nature. Because Mel, you know, he makes fun of everybody. But when we played the conservative cities, they screamed with laughter. They love jokes about gay and Jewish and Black and Irish. They love that. They just gave themselves permission to laugh. So that I found to be a very interesting set of circumstances.
It really is. And there's another thing that's very interesting to me about your book. As you take us through your experiences visiting and working in 26 American cities, there's this theme that's running through the book, and it's this: gentrification and elimination of history. You frequently lamented the deterioration and disappearance of famous landmarks in many cities that you had enjoyed when you were there 20 years before. Was that a bit of a downer for you on the tour?
You know, what's going on in the United States, it's bad enough that, there's a right wing that basically is autocratic. They're fascists. The Republican Party's a fascist party at this stage of the game. But on the far left, they are engaged in this cancel culture in which, and in both cases, it's minority rule. You can't flirt backstage. And let's say you're in a cast of 20. All it takes is one person to object to an ethnic joke, a flirtatious comment. My theory about this is that young people are facing such a difficult future with climate change that some of them are jumping on this because it's one of the few things they feel they can affect. You know, as I travel to my friends in North Carolina, and this is the birthplace of Stonewall Jackson, well, what are you going to do? You're going to say that you can't have that sign there anymore, that Stonewall Jackson didn't exist? How do we learn from all of the horrors of history? Are you going to say that we shouldn't read books about the Nazis? We shouldn't learn about Adolf Hitler and the destruction of the Weimar Republic? We shouldn't learn about Huey Long. There's an airport in Santa Ana, the John Wayne Airport. There was a group of people, again, on the left, and I consider myself, I'm on the left, but I'm like 20% left to center. They want to rename it because they don't like John Wayne's politics. Well, you don't have to approve of everything as long as it's, not causing irreparable harm to you. People are entitled to their own opinion.
You know, I really admire you for having the guts to speak out publicly in your book about things that very few people will talk about, this current working environment. And it's not just in the theater, it's everywhere. It's completely dominated by political correctness, the paranoia around any behavior that might even remotely be perceived as sexual harassment. I mean, Mr. Stadlin, we're living in a world where some people actually believe that the song Baby It's Cold Outside is about date rape. It's crazy, isn't it?
I don't think that there's a song that Frank Lesser has ever written in which they can't find some sort of objectionable sexual context. Luck be a lady. I want to get you on a slow boat to China. Standing on the corner watching all the girls go by. Yeah, and just in terms of, I got into this, I think, in the beginning of the interview, because all of a sudden I was being looked upon in a more favorable light by the women that I interacted with. You can't even compliment somebody. Sometimes you don't even have to say anything. Somebody could object to the way you look at them. When I was doing the front page on Broadway, I said to a woman, she must have been in her late 30s, I said, you, in rehearsal, we're in the rehearsal room, I said, you have beautiful legs.
Oh.
Okay, nothing happened. Then when we were performing at night in previews and rehearsing, I said to the same woman, I said, you look very fetching in that dress. I said, that's a wonderful color for you. I was read the riot act. I was told I was out of line. So what I'm saying to you, Harvey, is why memorize all those lines if you can't flirt?
You're so right. Well, try being a judge for 26 years where every word you say in the courtroom is being transcribed. And I'll tell you, it's stressful. Mr. Stadlin, I want to read you something that you wrote that really moved me. You said, and I'm quoting you here, there are moments in a long career when putting yourself out there becomes nothing short of demoralizing. that awful moment when you can no longer convince yourself that doing your best is a priority. It happens to all of us. Either you go on hiatus until you're able to reclaim your nerve, or you keep diminishing what you've previously accomplished. It's a horrible dilemma. So, Mr. Stadlin, what brings on those moments in a career, and how did you deal with them?
Just life and career disappointment. I remember doing, they have this thing at the link at the City Center in New York called the Encore Series. And I was doing Wonderful Town. And I was playing a part that I could have done in my sleep. He was curmudgeonly old landlord of Greek ancestry. And I had to go out there, and I was in the wings, and I was going to do a scene with a wonderful actor, Pecky Baker. And I thought to myself, what if you go out there and you don't do your best? Anybody going to know? Why should you have to go out there and do your best? And the moment that that passed my brain, I said, oh, that's death. That's death for an actor when you don't go out there and try to tell the story the best way you can. Which leads me to, it's not about going out there and saying, how is this going to reward Louis Stadlin? It's about telling the story the best way you can, bringing the audience in, justifying the fact that they have paid too much to see a piece of theater. You have to, I tell a Tammy Grimes anecdote that, you know, that Tammy, who I idolized and was in love with when I was 13, that we did a TV show and she showed up and she didn't know the lines and you could tell that she was in a state of distress. And I thought, this woman who has been so magnificent and has had such a terrific career, you could see she's really feeling bad. And I thought, I'm never going to allow myself to feel that way. And after we closed in Hello, Dolly, I was asked to do a concert version at Carnegie Hall of Let Him Eat Cake, which was a sequel to Of Thee I Sing, playing a character that I had done to much greater effect and other things. And I didn't want to be there. And I was lousy. And I thought, I never want to get to that point. And I think it's time to give up the ghost and say that I'm retired. And then a ex-student of mine who was the artistic director of a theater in Flint, Michigan, has a 150-seat repertory theater. He called up, he said, how would you like to play Willie Loman? I said, yeah, sure, I'd like to do that. And I realized it's about the part. You know, in a 55-year career, you've mentioned the highlights. There are so many times you do crap for the rent, to pay the rent. And the one thing that I do pride myself on is that I've tried to minimize that and really work most of the time in projects that I actually believe in and not just to enhance my celebrity.
Well, you know, if there's one thing about you, Mr. Stadlin, that really shines through in both of your books, in my opinion, it's resilience. I'll give you an example. After your highly acclaimed performance as Dr. Semmelweis in Buffalo, a British actor by the name of Colin Blakely was hired for the production headed for Broadway, and you were devastated. You were profoundly betrayed by the director, Ed Sheeran, whom you thought would support you in the litigation with the union. You were even disappointed by your wife at the time, Kathy, who accepted a part in the show. And then when Colin Blakely was fired for not delivering in the role, and you were offered the part, you asked for the same money that they were paying Colin, and they refused. How did you develop the resilience to get through very traumatizing experiences like that.
Well, what happened was I thought I can't depend on anybody anymore other than myself. So I got together with my friend, Denny Martin Flynn, and we put together a two-character play about Groucho Marx. And I toured it. I produced it. Denny directed it. We co-wrote it. We did mostly one-nighters. And I got myself back on my feet. Every actor goes through these lulls. And, you know, when you talk about the people who have committed their lives to stardom, the sad thing about some of them, stardom is finite. You know, you can't be on top. You can't be the first one in line for 55 years. And so a lot of times people who have dedicated themselves to being celebrities, they become empty vessels. Because they say, gee, I was going to be the next Spencer Tracy. Well, there's only one Spencer Tracy. And ironically enough, Spencer Tracy, who could create the illusion of balance and wisdom, was a tortured alcoholic, violent. So I think, and I say this to young people, in order to survive the rigors of being an artist, being an interpretive artist, which is what actors are. If you feel you have other options, like, well, I could either do this or I could be a veterinarian. The reason why I've been able to persevere is because I never felt that. Now I can teach, now I can write. But for the first 35 years, I didn't feel I had any other skills than to be an interpretive artist.
Well, you had no plan B, but you certainly had resilience. I mean, look at early on in your career, you worked with Luther Adler, who played Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. You said he was an actor of large talent who had allowed his soul to become eroded by a lifetime of envy and professional disappointment. So, Mr. Stadlin, given all the disappointments and injustices that inevitably occur in a long show business career like yours, you avoided turning into a Luther Adler. Do you get that? You did it.
No, I realized a few years ago that I was a nice guy. And you pick up these lessons because Luther, who I didn't think he was a good Tevye. He hazed me. I mean, it was really, I guess he thought that I didn't deserve to be on the same stage with him. And maybe he was right. I was only 19, 20. But the way he treated me, I have been in circumstances in which I felt the same way about a young actor. And I thought, well, I could either go the Luther route and make his life a living hell, or I could step aside and let him, with certain modifications, reap his own, destructive path and not be a bastard. And I've worked with very few bastards. I really have. Most of the people that I have worked with, the fraternity of acting, and that's the thing about the book and the road. That's what I wanted to convey. It's about people helping each other. On Broadway, after the show opens, you're punching a clock. But when you're on the road, you're always with each other. And there are very few options. When you're on Broadway, most of the time, you walk in there and four people are out. On the road, that never happens because there's nothing really that you can do in that one night that you're taking off. And besides the variety and going to places like, I played your beautiful city at the Royal Alex with Guys and Dolls. I was in heaven, to see how other people live, to be able to travel on the company dime. And because Fiddler on the Roof was my initial experience, and I think it was the first time I really felt successful, the road has taken on a romantic context, that's where I'm happiest. I'm happiest, and I think most clearly when I am in transit.
Well, that certainly came through in the book. You know, maybe Hume Cronin was right that if you're not exceedingly sexy, you're never going to be a really big star. But character actors have a lot more longevity and versatility than the matinee idols, I think. I'm in such awe of what you've achieved in your life and the person that you are. I only have one more question for you. Are you ready?
Yeah, so sweet. Thank you. Yeah, what?
Stella Adler told you that you need to have a deep recognition of your solitude to live the way you should live. So do you think that over the years you finally acquired that deep recognition?
I'm relatively content, and I'm content even being in semi-retirement. I'm surprised how I love everything about the theater. I mean, I love the dressing room. I love the makeup. I love the travel to the stage door. But I was shocked at how comfortable I was that I didn't need to do it in this past year and a half. I would like to fall in love again. I don't have a romantic companion. That's lacking. I would like that commonality. I would like to be able to travel and see the world with somebody who is to a certain extent like-minded and could help me grow. So I'm a relatively content man. And when I think of where I came from and the neurotic sensibilities of my initial family unit, I think it's kind of amazing that I'm where I'm at.
I think you should be immensely proud of who you are, what you've achieved. I have to tell you, Mr. Stadlin, I've immensely enjoyed meeting you and having this opportunity to talk about your amazing life and career. I know I kept you way over time, but thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
It was a great pleasure, and I hope this is the beginning of a real friendship, because I've enjoyed this immensely, and you seem like an absolutely wonderful human being.
Well, right back at you. You are welcome back on our show anytime. I hope there's a way to get you to come back to the Royal Alex here in Toronto, because Canada loves you. Don't ever forget that.
I won't forget it.
Our guest has been the brilliant and iconic actor, Louis J. Stadlin, whose latest book entitled Save Me a Seat, On the Road with Hello Dolly, is now available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Deborah Batsafin, my production assistant, Rosa Apuzzo, my PR director, Laurie Towers, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.